Welcome to GDN's Talking Comics Interview. On today's show, we welcome back screenwriter-creator Tom Pinchuk. We last talked to Tom about his book, Remember Andy Zenon. Now, Tom is once again teaming with artist Nikos Koutsis on a new series through the new content platform, Kipsel. The new series, Clash of the Classics, combines two beloved and classic literary adventure stories into new and exciting tales. Starting with the first book in the series, Don Quixote Fights the War of the Worlds. Now, here's your host, Martin Sexton.
Welcome once again to another edition of GDN's Talking Comics Interview. I am your host, Martin, and today we welcome back writer, screenwriter, creator, Tom Pinchuk. Last time we talked to Tom, it was all about his book, Remember Andy Zenon, with artist Nikos Koutsis. But Tom's not one to rest on past successes because he's teaming once again with Nico, this time through a new content platform, Kipsel, on a new anthology series, Clash of the Classics, remixing famous literary epics into utterly unpredictable and, quite frankly, entertaining stories. The first being a great preview of things to come, Don Quixote Fights the War of the Worlds. So let's talk comics by welcoming back Tom Pinchuk to GVN's Talking Comics Interview. Thanks for coming back to visit us today, Tom. How are we doing?
Oh, great. Thanks for having me, Martin.
All right. I appreciate it. Okay. So just to remind folks, Tom is a multi-talented writer. He has worked on television, of course, comics, but he also teaches a writing course through UCLA Extension, which I believe in this fall, I think you have a continuation course for students working on a half hour television pilot. During your time of instructing students in writing, who do you think gets more out of it, you or your students?
Well, I always like to say my students, I hope so. I've really come to enjoy it a lot as a teacher. It was not something I really expected. I think that I was going to be adding to my my CV, but I met a rep for UCLA Extension actually at Comic-Con. It was at a WGA party, and we got to talking, and he said, "Would you be interested in teaching?" I said, "Sure." You know, and I went through it, and I've really come to enjoy it a lot. The course that I'm teaching this coming quarter is the second part of developing a half hour pilot, but I've also taught writing half hour specs, which is just like a sample episode that you write. If you want to say, I don't know, if you want to write like Abbott Elementary or Rick and Morty, to show that you could, write in that realm. And I've been doing it a few years now. We kind of even had to adjust during the pandemic as well, which was kind of fascinating. I was sort of actually the kind of the guinea pig because I taught the last class the last day that UCLA campus was open, ending at 10 o'clock. And then I also then taught the first, what we would call an intensive, once they resumed instruction, and we were all kind of figuring it out as we went along. Actually, what's cool too is that next winter, I always have to get adjusted to saying winter at the beginning of the year because I always think of winter as the end, but I think in academic terms, it's really the beginning. I'll be teaching a pretty intense, like a 4-day workshop for writing comics actually at UCLA. So that'll be pretty interesting. That's where we're just starting that now, and I had to do all the proposals for it. So that's gonna be pretty fun. I've really enjoyed the experience. I think it's been, I think maybe more than anything, it's gotten me to empathize with editors that I've worked with, the story editors, because I really find myself in that position now, because I'll have students who I'm trying to guide them, and literally I am editing their work. I am story editing their work, and giving them notes and trying to, get them in a direction for the class. So I would love to say it's been reciprocal. I think I've generally the students have, I've had some who've been very vocal in saying how much they enjoyed it, and they've really felt they went on an odyssey and learned a lot in my class, which is definitely very satisfying to hear. Although there's always the cases too where they go off in the world and you're sort of you're hoping you made a good impression. So I think that's how I would phrase it. I definitely enjoy it for sure.
I say, so do you have a problem with being critical with your students, or are they pretty much are used to that, so they don't, you know, take it, offense to it or anything like that.
It's interesting because I didn't come in from UCLA Extension really prides itself on people who are working in the industry, as opposed to if we were dealing with a professor who may be someone who has a degree in teaching, but maybe not experience writing professionally. And I think there's pluses and minuses to both, for sure. There was definitely a learning curve early on that I just had to get used to. But I only bring that up in the sense that a lot of my guiding philosophy is honestly just remembering bad teachers that I've had, maybe more so than good ones, which is unfortunate because I have had some good ones. But I think that people are learning, and I think it's, there are more constructive ways to help somebody and to guide them than it is to really browbeat them. And it's something that I've heard from students and certainly experienced myself, where I think there are some instructors who or teachers in any field. I mean, I think you deal with these personalities anywhere who seem to get a rise really more out of browbeating. And I don't think it's very constructive. I don't think it really, I don't think it's a good way to teach, in my opinion. I think that there's, you know, there are students whose work is more raw than others, for sure. But I think it's better to, there's always ways that you can present notes. I think that it, you know, and I think my trait is in words. So I think when I'm presenting it as, there are ways to phrase it where you're saying the same thing and you're trying to get the same result, but I think you can phrase it more positively than to phrase it in such a way that you're trying to break somebody down, which I don't like.
Very good. Okay, so like I said, last time we talked, we were promoting Remember Andy Zenon through Zoop,
yes.
Which was fully funded. So how was the experience with Zoop, and what do you think you've kind of learned through that whole experience?
Oh, a lot. I mean, I think above all, I as much reading as I did ahead of time about trying to self-publish or work on a crowdfunding platform. I think Zoop was a unique case because they were sort of kind of hovering between sort of a publisher, sort of a new platform, sort of a crowdfunder. And I think that as much as you read ahead of time, there's nothing that's ever going to prepare you for experience. So as much, and I definitely learned a lot from doing that. We ran into, I guess to talk a little bit of shop about it. One thing that we ran into was just that what I mused about was, a lot of the motive for doing the book was that Nikos and I had been working on a project together in 2020, and we got interrupted by the pandemic. There was a company that we knew, that probably three editors we knew got laid off, and retailers were closing up, or they were just not closing permanently, but were closed to the public. And then also there was a real upheaval in comics distribution, and we wanted to think of ways to sidestep that. And so Zoop really presented itself at the right time is to go directly to readers and get the book to them. What I laughed about, I think in a few months down the line, was we ran into supply chain issues, and which everybody's dealing with in one way or another right now. And there was a time where we did have to give, you know, as much as we tried to mitigate everything by having the book done in advance and having everything done, when it came time to printing, there was an issue because we were looking at an overseas printer that was going to be giving us a good rate, but then they couldn't give us any guarantee, or not even a guarantee, but any estimate on a shipping date, meaning right. That it could, you know, if we print the book, it could come in 6 days or it could come in 6 months. And that was just unacceptable to me. I didn't want to be doing continual updates to the readers and saying like, hey, well, I wish I had a better answer for you. So that took a little time to find a domestic printer, which we wound up doing, and we found a really good one. And then we ran into paper shortages, which sort of affected things. But then the book eventually, we got it, and people were really happy with how it came out. I think that the printing quality was great. It was like a prestige format book. I think that there's always those moments of, crossing your fingers because I think the nature of the one that we were working with, they weren't really going to give us a proof copy. That was just sort of the trade-off, you know, the one that we were looking for initially was going to give us a proof, but then this one, it wasn't in the card for that. So then we just, you try to do your best and communicate to them what paper stock you want and how you want the binding and making sure that the files are all correct. But then you just have to have that leap of faith when the books come in, and they came out really well. Actually, what's to segue too? I mean, I've had a really fun odyssey over the past couple months, because when we made the book, we never had a distributor in mind. It was really, I mean, there's so many things. I think again of a lot of the lessons I've learned from doing this is just that I think going into it, I didn't have a thorough grasp of what an editor does in comics, and now I think I do in all capacities, just because it is very challenging to be doing the creative aspect of producing a comic in addition to all the administrative tasks. It's a lot. In this case also, I became a distributor because I had boxes and boxes of books. I had hundreds of copies, and I didn't really plan ahead if I was going to be going to conventions or when those would be happening. And so I decided stores are opening up. I don't know if this is the old fashioned way, but I'm going to go try it. I rolled up my sleeves and I got some, put the boxes in the back of my trunk, and I hit the road, and I went to every comic store in every area code that was around me. And I went pretty much from like city to city, county to county, even state to state. And at this count, we have dozens of stores. I'm always bad with numbers. I don't remember the exact one off the hand, but we did a, you know, if you follow my newsletter, we did have a pretty long list of them. And I just found it honestly one of the best experiences of my career. I think that, you know, what can I say? I like interacting with people. I think that there's so much of when you're creating a comic is just being in your own, and it's being, you know, in your head. And it's just, there's something very surreal and rewarding about being able to talk to somebody face to face about what you've made and having the book there and, you know, seeing their reaction to it in real time. And it was generally a positive response. I also think that something that I came away with is I think that there also is a lot of discussions of the comics industry or the retailer space, I think is unnecessarily negative. I would probably even say sensationalistic, because I found a very vibrant scene. There were lots of stores. There were more stores than I could physically go to, let me put it that way. Mm-hmm. And what I found also really encouraging was it was just a real variety of stores. So there were these big chains. There were also more cozy independents. And there were also stores that had been around for decades, and they've been still going strong. And also, I'd say equally inspiring, there were a surprising number of stores that opened during the pandemic. You know, they had a dream, and they were going to make it happen regardless of the circumstances. And so it was really wonderful. And I'm really grateful to everybody who bought copies of the books. These retailers who just entertained the stranger walking in with the box of books they never heard of before. I was doing the kind of classic door-to-door sales technique, but it was great. And so we've been having, there are a fair number of stores now that do have Andy Zena on the shelves, and we never had a distributor.
Excellent. So actually, you just segue right into what I was going to talk about. So good job there. Hey. So as far as Comic-Cons go, you know, like you said, they are starting to open up now. You know, we're still fighting a little bit of the pandemic, but you know, some of the cons are opening up. Have you had a chance to go to any of those?
Yeah, I was at San Diego Comic-Con last month. I'll confess there was a bit of trepidation going into it, I suppose some mix of cautious optimism. I would say it was about 70% from what I could observe of what it would normally be, which is still overwhelming, I think, for any human being. I do want to pay compliments to CCI for the security measures that they took, and also the screening measures that they took, because I think those are very, very hard tasks. And it's also something that's kind of this invisible job that happens at these conventions. They definitely deserve some credit for that. Good to just talk to people face to face. And I was giving them copies of the book and, you know, giving it to colleagues and to giving it to publishers as well. You know, catching up with some people. I think normally I wasn't tabling this year. I wasn't in Artist Alley, and I wasn't doing any signings. Whenever I go to convention, I really try to attack it, basically, which is maybe not the best choice of words, I suppose, now that I mentioned security. But I mean that I try to go in with, like, not, you know, leaving no stone unturned and no moment wasted. which usually translates at Comic-Con to me losing my voice by night two, or at least, but definitely by day three. And so I'll have be meeting people at conventions. It's always very charming to say, hi, you know, and I, you know, I try to go, there's been some times where I'll go to parties and maybe I'll get triple booked, but this time I was like, look, if it doesn't, I'm not going to chase anything. If it doesn't manifest and it's not easy and it's not going to just, you know, on my lap, I'll be perfectly content staying in my hotel room and rather than going all night and getting up early and only maybe getting like a few scant hours of sleep. Because I think even in a good year, you're typically have, like they say, the con crud, you know, you get some kind of some bug after the convention. And I really didn't want to risk that this time. So I, you know, knock on wood, I managed to go get through it without getting sick. And I think it was a pretty successful convention. I still think it's a little, to be totally honest, it's a little awkward when you're networking with half your face covered. I understand that, you know, I think it's been the thing that's been fascinating in all the facets over the past few years, a couple of years, I suppose, with masking is you forget the number of times that you talk to somebody where half their face is covered and then you see them with the mask off and you feel like they look like a completely different person. And I think that especially at a convention, it's something that if you're meeting somebody new, you know, if you're changing business cards or what have you, it really is, it's a little difficult, especially on a loud convention floor to have to shadow over the din with another layer. But, you know, I think they're easing back into it. I think all of this is kind of like baby steps. Even with UCLA, just this quarter, we did have a mask mandate and they just lifted it last week. So I think there a lot of this is incremental updates. So, you know, I had a good time. I enjoyed Comic-Con. It was definitely worthwhile to go to. Coincidentally, I suppose, but it looks like I won't be going to any other conventions for the rest of the year, but not because of any kind of like leeriness on my part, but mainly just because I have a conflict actually like every weekend that they're happening. So,
right. Okay, so let's get talking about what's going on now. Okay, so you've hooked up with Kipsel, which is a new content platform with kind of a unique sales model. Can you tell us a little or follow us a little bit about it and how you got connected with them?
Well, I think the second part I'll start with, and I'll get the first. There's Victor Schuker, who's one of the partners in the company, is a friend of mine. I've known him a few years, and he reached out to me. And initially, they were looking to be getting into they were looking to get into the space of just a content platform. It was initially for books. I think it's mostly for books, and I think there's some music on it right now. And they were interested in doing comics. And so initially I was just getting consulted, and I think they liked what I was telling them, I guess the advice I was giving them about comics. So they asked me, would I want to pitch something to them? And I said, sure. And so we were batting around a number of ideas, and then it just seemed that this Clash of the Classics would be a good fit. I'll get to more of that in a minute. As to how their business model works, I think their approach was that they felt that having like a street team for a book is maybe like, you know, it was effectively kind of taking word of mouth, I think, to like the next step, meaning that if perhaps you incentivize people who are already likely to like try to talk a book up to their friends in the digital space. I think that's been, I think there's been a bit of an adjustment over the past like a few years in terms of, okay, well, there was a whole notion of collectability and trading and so on and so forth. Right. When you had physical media that maybe doesn't translate as much when you have digital. And I think what their approach was with this sales model was to bring more of that back. So the notion being that, you know, if you buy Clash of the Classics, you then have the option actually to sell it to friends. So it won't be for as much, but it'll be for a percentage of the cover price. And the hope is that if we have someone who's really taken with Clash of the Classics and really wants people to read it and to share in their enjoyment of it, now they have just like that much more incentive to do so. So as far as I know, I think they're the only ones doing that. It's an exciting model. I think that I think with whenever it comes to any platform that I've worked with, any publisher I've worked with, I can't speak too comprehensively about that because I certainly, they commissioned me and I got to make the comics that I wanted to make. And I was really surprised at the creative freedom I was allowed. And I just sort of like leave it up to them about how, where it goes from there. But it's an exciting, model to see how it unfolds.
Okay, so we're talking about Clash of the Classics, which I think is a great idea. I think you described it sort of almost like Marvel's What If, but in your case, you get to use the whole literary world as your point of view. I was going through your chronicles, your Chuck Chronicles on Substack, and you had mentioned something about you was doing an online film class, and of course they asked you about where your ideas came from, and you had said that they come from everywhere, including the stories you've read, which kind of fits right into this. Your first book is Don Quixote Fights the War of the Worlds. So how did you come together to mix those two together?
We kind of went through a brainstorming process, and I think we were just seeing like which ones were like the in the literary tradition that we just thought would still be relevant today. And sometimes it's just a bolt of blue. I don't know. It's just it kind of just seemed like the image of Don Quixote squaring off with a Martian tripod was just it just came to me, and it just seemed to fit. I think that above all. Because as you said, the way we've been describing this to people is it's like What If, but with classic adventure characters. So typically, what we're planning to do is to take a character from one book, like say Don Quixote, and put him in the plot of another one, which in this case is War of the Worlds, and then just see what happens from there. And I think that the overriding creative inspiration for me was I always try to get back in touch with who I was, as a reader, at whatever age. And I suppose it even goes back to the question you're having earlier about being a student, versus being a teacher. I as much as I love literature and the literary tradition, I don't think I'm alone in saying there have been some times where I was in grade school and I was bored and maybe not super engaged with the material. And sometimes the little naughty mind that you have starts to imagine how perhaps the story could go in more exciting ways. And I think that there's been a bit of a, there's been more of an audience for that. I mean, I think that we pointed to, say, Pride and Prejudice and Zombies as an example of something that was definitely kind of caught on with people, that perhaps they were reading Jane Austen and wanting to have, flesh-eating monsters show up. So I was just really taken with the idea of just ruining the point of Don Quixote, basically. We did our research. I mean, what I said to them was, if we're going to be using public domain characters, I want to make sure that they're all, I don't want to cheat and just rely on the popular conceptions of them, or say like, we only watched like, I don't know, Bela Lugosi's Dracula, or having watched that movie all the way through. I said, I want to actually really base this off the book, because, I think especially in comics, you have plenty of cases where it's like, it was Dracula versus the Wolfman in Oz. And it's just, it doesn't seem especially clever, and it doesn't seem especially, authentic to the books. And so we really wanted to, what I found more inspiring was getting into the nitty gritty details and trying to make it like sort of play it straight, despite how ridiculous it gets sometimes. And so something that I was struck by, and I think honestly this was the case in any of the research that I did, was that almost any time I read these books, I realized that the popular conceptions of them were wrong, or they missed something, or a lot of times that there was a certain, that people would describe there being subtext in a book that really just is the text. I think that so in the case of Don Quixote, what really struck me was I was about like a few chapters in, and I realized this is Kick-Ass in medieval time. Like, it really just, the parallels were actually kind of striking. It was, you have someone who's reading too many stories of adventures and heroes and starts to believe it and wants to set out to be one and is then really inept at it. And so I just kind of thought that, I think that continually when you read Don Quixote, he's failing. Like, that's the point. It's just that he doesn't know what he's doing, and he's seeing things that aren't there, and he's he's a giant in his own mind, so to speak, even though he's mistaking the windmills for giants. And I just thought to myself, like, what if he could kick ass? what if we let him win? Like, we let him actually be a knight and let him really fight monsters. And, perhaps there could be some wonderful irony in the fact that, apart from everybody else in Spain at the time, he's actually uniquely qualified to fight these monsters because he's been training at it for many years. So, that was just really too irresistible to not explore.
I said, well, of course, I'm kind of embarrassed. I am, other than just like on the outside looking in, I wasn't that familiar with Don Quixote, other than the Gordon Lightfoot song, which I knew that. It was actually very interesting. Okay, whose idea was it to put the windmill blades on the alien ships? Because I thought that was fabulous.
That actually was Kipsel's idea. I'll confess, that was not my initial conception, but they thought it would be cool to, the initial designs that Nikos had were more futuristic for the tripods. As I also found out, they're never referred to as tripods actually in War of the Worlds. They're called fighting machines exclusively. But his initial designs were more futuristic, and we were just thinking that maybe that wasn't as unique, because we did want to employ some creative license in this. I think it's always with creative licenses about picking your battles. And so in this case, the suggestion came on that perhaps they should look a little more steampunk-esque, just because it's set in the past. And we perhaps to differentiate them from the other tripods, we decided to give them I think we sort of found like a middle ground where I was suggesting that they maybe look more like solar panels. So like they're not specifically just like blades. I was a little skeptical about that idea, but Nikos really made it work. He really executed in such a way, and so once it was done, I couldn't really argue with it.
And I wasn't sure as I was reading, I was wondering if this was just as Don Quixote was seeing it, or if this was actually what it looked like. I don't know. You tell me.
It's all real. It's all real. As a personal preference, I've never really been a fan of, like, it was always a dream endings. I think that sometimes it just feels like you've kind of invested into a story up until a certain point, and then if at the end it's kind of this fake out and saying that, oh, whoops, none of it really happened, it kind of takes me out of it. So I found it more interesting just to have it be like, no, this is all real. He's not imagining. He doesn't have the firmest grasp, I guess what I would confirm, but like whatever you're seeing is what you get. Like it is happening. It is real. It is in all the bloody viscera of it.
I say, and of course, Nico, as you said, did a great job on it. Of course, that's not the first time you're working with Nico. Mm-hmm. So what is it, I think, about Nico's art that merges so well with your stories?
I've always been a fan of, for lack of a better term, cartoonier art, but something that also combines a lot of detail. So it's something that I was a huge fan of Chris Bachalo's work and Duncan Rouleau's. And I think, Nikos, he's definitely was influenced by Todd McFarlane. And I think we've heard a lot of comparisons to Greg Capullo to his work. And it's something that I think there's, to my mind, I just my sensibility and a lot of the books that I'm drawn to kind of have like that sort of sense of it's a very delicate middle ground of if it's too photoreal, sometimes it feels like I'm not it looks like I'm looking like Fumetti, it's like a series of photographs, it feels a little stiff, but then sometimes if it's too cartoonish, it feels a little too flimsy. So I try to I kind of gravitate to stuff that's more in the middle, where there is a kind of wonderful energy to it and gesture and expression, but he's also really putting in his due diligence with texture and weight and detail for sure. And so yeah. I think there is a degree of I gravitated to his work for that. I think also we've wound up working well together because I like to make my scripts pretty detailed. I like to put a lot of thought and effort into them. I know that there's some who like to write a little more frenetically, but I like to have a sense of density and detail, in the sense that you could read this once and then when you go back over, you'll notice more things that you didn't notice the first time. And he's been very receptive to that, actually. It's someone that, you know, depending on your relationships with your artists, there's some that they don't like that as much, but he works with it really well. And it's also something that he loves detail, and he loves those, you know, that level of density as well. So I think our sensibility is definitely aligned.
Excellent. Okay, so this is, I'm assuming, is the first of the Clash of the Classic series. So what other combinations can fans hope for here in the future?
Well, I guess to preface all of that, we're taking our time, because I think just like the nature of how we're doing the content platform, we didn't want to make this something that we just crank out one after the other. I think that it's something especially that I learned from having worked on either, like, you know, you've got your regular deadlines like week to week, versus something that you can really take your time to take your time, really. You know, you can put more time into it. And I think it's when I really thought also about comics that I've loved, I think the prestige format books are something that came out maybe more on a, you know, they come out when they're ready, is something that I think lasts a bit longer than something that's also just that we had to get it out like once a month or once a week even. So we're taking our time with the next two, but the ones that we do tease at the end of it, well, you know, I'm not gonna spoil, but you know, if you get to the end of the book, you'll see some teases of what they are, and that's they're pretty exciting. I think they're also going to be, we wanted to stick to ones that were the audience would be familiar with. There, the one that I could say the one that probably won't be happening is when Dr. Doolittle visited the island of Dr. Moreau. As much as I thought that would have really been a slam dunk and would have made a lot of sense, we just kind of found out that we did a bit of research and found that those don't really, they don't have as much kind of cachet, I think, with audiences today, or as much awareness. Maybe someday if we keep doing these, we'll get around to that. I think, and the hope is also that we're going to have a degree of, you know, the tone will be a little different. I think this one was, we were striking a very, we wanted to lead with action, and it's really action packed. And there's certainly humor. I think it would be impossible to do a Don Quixote book without humor. Right. I think that would really be, to my mind, that would have been a deep misunderstanding of, you know, of the character if we didn't do that. But the next one is going to be a little more, leaning more towards horror, a little more understated. And then I think the last one, I think we'll probably like veer even further into comedy. But again, we're taking our time with these. So we'll have a tease. Like, they'll be coming out for sure, but it won't necessarily be like the month after this. This is released. And then, you know, we'll be making sure that we really want to make these are things that are like less a periodical and more just like, it's a one shot. It's something that you can enjoy and keep, you know, really savoring, as opposed to just saying, hey, wait, where's the next one? Let me move on to that one, right?
Right. Okay. Well, thanks again for sharing a bit of your time with us, Tom. But before I let you go, I want to give you an opportunity to talk about whatever, any other projects you might have going on, as well as where can fans follow you on social media and the web?
Well, I guess the answer to the second one would be, I have, as you mentioned, I have a newsletter called the Chuck Chronicles that's on Substack. And so, and I'm also on Twitter. I honestly started the newsletter because I just couldn't keep up with social media. Like, I think it goes back to, I think that became especially even more of a concern when I was editing the comics as well as producing them and also distributing them, where it's just, there's only so many hours in the day. I couldn't really keep up with doing like daily updates, let alone even like hourly the way that some people can. So what I like about Substack and having a newsletter is, you know, you'll probably get about like about a month or so. And I'll go into a lot more detail than I prefer that as well, to trying to get something into, say, like 140 characters or whatever the limit is these days. So that'll be the place. Actually, I can mention now that you bring it up, I did recently do a story in Moon Lake, which was the latest volume of Moon Lake at Heavy Metal. It's called Guide to the Dark Side. I did that with I was picked by actually the Dan Fogler, who's an actor whose renown has been increasing a lot lately. He was just in The Offer at that story about the Godfather, you know, that miniseries about
Godfather.
Yeah, he played Francis Ford Coppola in that, and then he was also in Fantastic Beasts. He's one of those character actors that when you see, you'll probably realize you've seen him in dozens of things already. And yeah, he handpicked me to do a short story for his anthology, Moon Lake, which is like a really, you know, more like offbeat and kind of demented. I'd say it's like a more Adult Swim take on, say, like Tales from the Crypt. It's a horror anthology, but it veers more into kind of crazy comedy. So I did a story for that called Batshit Bottled Brilliance.
Which the mouthful.
It was, yeah. Well, it was funny because I think I brought that up just sort of like offhandedly, sort of as a joke before, as a placeholder before we found the real title. And then Dan said, like, no, that's great. We're going to go with that. And it's about Moon Lake. It's all these stories centered around this haunted lake. And so I had this idea of a high school athletic program that gets a shipment of bottled water that is all from, is bottled from Moon Lake. And the kids start to go a little crazy. There's degrees of like possession, but then the athletic director sees an opportunity to actually turn their program around because they're literally playing like demons. And so it gets crazier from there. The elevator pitch I've been using for it is like, it's like Hoosiers from Hell. So yeah, and I guess if I could circle back to any other point, I just want to maybe reiterate that, you know, the experience of going from store to store selling Andy Xenon was just such an amazing experience, and it's something that I really came to have a much deeper appreciation for your local comic book store, even than I did before. I don't think I ever really quite lost it, but I think it deepened after this, because I think especially, you know, there's been a lot of these. You know, you're seeing these documentaries about Blockbuster or what have you, which I don't really miss Blockbuster as much, because I was always more of a fan of like the local mom and pop tape stores, because the selection was much better and you could really have a conversation with the clerks. And it's something that's gone now, you know. It's you can go to Redbox,
right,
and you're not really talking to anybody, or you know, you go on Netflix and you're just having an algorithm pick things for you. It feels very impersonal. I don't think, honestly, I found a really robust industry. Like I said, I think in comics, I think there are some industries I feel like are really like, actually, honestly, I think they all are. Like, I think everybody loves the sky is falling narrative. Like, I'll talk to some people and saying like, oh, I don't think there's going to be any more like big blockbusters anymore. Like, you know, they're not going to be making any more of this like Blockbuster series. Are like, I mean, these make $1 billion. Like, I don't think this movie business is hurting right now. And I think that you know, that extends, like, I have friends in theater who people feel that way. I just think there's a lot of negativity about the comics industry that I think is a bit unwarranted in terms of where its history is going. Cause I definitely felt very encouraged by this, that it was very robust and these places were crowded and they had really, I mean, it was really wonderful too, that even I had like a kind of cozy hole in the wall store that was a bit messy and a bit dusty and dark, and they had like 350 subscribers, you know, and I think they were doing just great. So, but I think if I did have an opportunity to bring that up, is I just think that especially after being cooped up in one way or another for 2 years, it was just reminding me how much I love going to a comic store, talking to the clerk, getting recommendations, haggling for deals on back issues, you know, just the whole experience of it, which I think is really, that's an aspect of comics that I think is maybe more, you know, I think maybe you have that in say like a record store, but that's, you know, but I don't think you really get as much of that experience with say movies anymore. And so if anybody's listening to this, it's just, you know, go to your local comic store, like, you know, let them know they're appreciated, because I think that was something that I definitely gained a very regained, let's say, even a much deeper appreciation for on that whole sales trip.
Excellent. Of course, I think you also talked about that in your Chuck Chronicles in one of your articles about your travels to the comic stores. So we'll be following Clash of the Classics with great interest, and hopefully get to talk to you again in the future there, Tom.
Yeah, I got a few things, some other irons in the fire. So I'm hoping this is good. We'll be back sooner rather than later. So I just also learned though that I think especially after some of the delays we had with Andy Xenon's, thanks to Andy Xenon's release, thanks to like supply chain issues, that I try not to get ahead of myself too much. So at least in this case, we're it's available now. So if you go to Kipsell's site, you know, it's available to buy right now, and you can own it. And like I said, you can sell it to friends and spread the word and help everybody enjoys it.
All right. Well, we thank you very much. And we'll, like I said, we'll be following it real close. Appreciate it.
Likewise.
Thank you for listening to GVN's Talking Comics. Please come back again. Talking Comics is a production of Geek Vibes Nation.